In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Bill Clinton famously had a sign in the Oval Office. It's the economy, stupid. President Trump does not need that sign. He lives and breathes the economy every day. But the sign that every member of the House and Senate, both parties, need in their offices should read, "It's the national debt, stupid." Both parties got us into this. Both parties need to fix this. I think many Republicans are trying to. I don't see any efforts whatsoever out of the Democrats to try to cut anything. All they do is try to stop anyone from trying to fix any problems. But hint to the Republicans, it is not okay to overspend simply because your party is in charge. As for Trump, he didn't seem overly worried about the debt and deficits. I wish he would push more aggressively for spending cuts, huge ones. I believe in Trump. I just wish that he would share a little bit more about how he plans to fix this, but of course when you're making deals, you keep your cards hidden. If Democrats, and probably some Republicans, knew what cards he was going to play and how he plans to fix things, they would do everything to sabotage it. So, we'll have to be patient and just trust. Trump is not afraid to borrow money, because when he borrows, he does so to make more money than he borrows. And that is very different from current government thinking, which is to borrow simply to spend more with no thought on costs or to achieve any value at all, other than to get reelected by handing out someone else's money. And while Trump knows how to borrow responsibly, we are dealing with decades and decades of borrowing that have put us in this massive hole. I think Republicans needed a new slogan, 2019 or bust, because we absolutely cannot keep spending at the current levels. In 2019, we spent $4.5 trillion. In 2024, that exploded to $6.9 trillion. That's an increase of over 50%. Moody's recently downgraded America's credit rating because of the exploding debt. Last year, we borrowed $2 trillion to spend that $6.9 trillion. And right now, we borrow every dollar that we use to pay the interest on our national debt. Interest payments eat up 20% of all federal income, and by 2030, that will rise to 30%. 30% right off the top of our income just to pay interest. I have my own thoughts on how Trump plans to get us out of this debt, but I'll have to save that for another show and another time. But the first step is to get this big, beautiful bill passed, and then I think the rest of it will make more sense. On this week's show, we want to fill in the gaps of what you're not hearing about all of this in the left-stream media and help you better understand what you might be hearing in other, more reliable media. To talk about all that, I would like to welcome back Jonathan Williams. He is the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, it's great to talk to you.
Always great to talk with you, my friend. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's so much to talk about. We could probably have easily done two or even three shows on the economy. There's just so much going on. And in the upcoming segments, we'll talk about Trump's reciprocal tariffs, Doge and the fraud, waste, and abuse that they uncovered, and then get into Moody's recent downgrade of America's credit rating and Trump's big, beautiful bill. And hopefully we'll have time to talk about Oregon as well in the last segment if we can. But let's start with an overall view of the economy. And the last time that you and I had talked was about 10 days before Trump took office, about making the economy great again. And at the same time, Joe Biden, or at least his auto pen, was busily throwing gold bars off the Titanic on his way out the door, giving away billions as going away presents. In a general sense, how are things going, do you think? Are we moving in the right direction? And do you have some favorite moves you've seen so far?
Well, you know, let's start with the fact that I think President Trump inherited a very fragile economy in some respects, right? And it's something that was set up because of a full 4 years of government on really autopilot when it comes to overspending. And you know, you had the Biden administration and there for a while, their majorities in Congress finding every single spending program that they liked and then upping the ante from there and even spending more. And when you want to be, if you're over-optimistic in a particular day and you want to bring yourself back down to reality, I encourage everyone to go to the U.S. debt clock.
Yes.
Because that outlines in detail where we're at right now when it comes to the national debt, overspending, and then what it means in terms of the price that we pay for the interest on the national debt now. And, you know, the other piece of that is the hidden tax of inflation that we talked a lot about during the Biden administration. And I remember, Mark, you and I having many of these conversations over the last 4 years. And first of all, Janet Yellen and the Biden administration tried to tell us what we were just making this up, that this inflation was just in our heads and it wasn't happening. And then we were told it was transitory, right? And there was just going to be a short-lived phenomenon. And then after many, many months of trying to explain things away and gaslight the American public into believing overspending wasn't causing inflation, like it always does, by the way, then the Biden administration started at least acknowledging the fact that there's inflation. And of course, their solution to it was to do exactly the wrong thing and have a bit more big government policies. And so, you know, all that is the prelude to the fact that when President Donald Trump took office in January of 2025, they were all those things that were already baked into the cake. And pretty quickly on, we know that, you know, even after the election, he wisely looked at the idea of, you know, let's take a look at the swamp and let's see how we can drain the swamp when it comes to overspending, and bringing in Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy from the start to talk about government waste and finding it through the DOGE idea. And we brought those folks into ALEC, and we've had some great conversations in the month since talking about what are these key ideas to bring things back from the brink that we were at. I think, you know, we were testing kind of world limits when it comes to how much spending and debt and that whole horrible cycle that we saw during the Biden administration, how far can we go without costing the United States greatly? And I think we already have paid some major costs to that. Yep. But obviously, immediately, President Trump wanted to come in and address that, which had to be job one, and other things like renewing the Trump tax cuts that I know we want to get into in more detail. So coming into that, that was the stage that I think was set. And the president came in very quickly, and some like criticize him for how quickly they've been acting. But I mean, he knew the urgency of the situation and say, we cannot continue down this track of now more than $36 trillion of national debt. We've got to start somewhere. And DOGE was a great place to start.
It was. We've only got about a minute here with you. Are there any moves that he's made that you don't like so much?
Well, I mean, there's something to like and not like about anybody, right? And but what we see about this president is he, I think, is focused in on the big things, which is we cannot continue to move the United States in the direction that it was headed when it comes to racking up the national debt. And we must address this looming issue that really plays right into the debt and the sustainability issue for the United States economy. And that is, if we allow the Trump tax cuts of 2017, the TCJA, to expire, I think we're almost guaranteed economic recession going forward because of that shock factor that would take on the economy, on businesses, and on the average taxpayer. A couple thousand dollars of tax increase on every individual across the country if Congress does nothing. And so between those things and reimagining education in this country, I had a chance, I don't think we've had a chance even to talk about it, Mark. I had a chance to have lunch with the president and a few governors in the White House right after he took office. And focusing in on those things, education reform, the economy, and addressing overspending in debt, I think those are all phenomenal areas to focus on for President Trump.
Yeah, well, there's so many things that he's trying to do, reshaping not just education, but also reshaping the entire American economy, getting us back to manufacturing type of economy, I think are all great. And you can see why he's rushing so much to get all of this done. It's a tremendous hill to climb in just 4 short years. All right, we are only just getting started. Coming up, tariffs, DOGE, and the big, beautiful bill. More with Jonathan Williams of American Legislative Exchange Council. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find out about the great work they do over at alec.org, alec.org. And so in this segment, I would like very much to talk about these tariffs, because watching Trump level those tariffs, the left, of course, howled because anything Trump does, they hate. But many think tanks and pundits on the right really missed the ball on tariffs as well. I mean, it's a total whiff. Rand Paul, you know, and I'm really speaking especially about these free trade absolutists, who Rand Paul is one. You know, he's a big libertarian. But he not only public hated on them, he then led a revolt in the Senate to try to overturn the tariffs on Canada. Trump has been in the public eye for 40-some years. He's written books about making deals. It's not like he's hidden his strategy to get things done. I understand why the left missed things, but I would think people on the right should have known Trump better and should have known what was going on. Why do you think so many missed that?
Well, it's a good question, Mark. You know, I think it's one of those things that, you know, tariffs are not a, as a, you know, a policy idea. You know, it's kind of like a tax increase, right? I mean, they're another way of getting there. And so I think that's why folks on the right have a reflexive response to tariff increases. Now, I think the difference is any times when I get asked about, you know, what do you think of what's going on the trade situation right now and tariffs and the White House proposals, and the first thing I do is I turn around and ask the individuals the question, have you read the book, The Art of the Deal?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I think that's exactly what has happened from day one, is that this is a beginning of a negotiation, that tariffs are not the ends in themselves, but they're a means to an end of a more, I think, robust discussion around trade and worldwide, and to make sure that America is being treated fairly around the world. And I think if you look at the actions of the president from the first term, he offered the G7 countries a zero-for-zero trade, free trade match, and they turned him down. So I think the inclinations of the president, he realizes that trade can be a very good thing, and he wants to work towards freer trade, but he wanted to have a reset. And I think that's what this discussion back from early April was a reset of the expectations, a reset of the longstanding trade, in his consideration, a lot of unfairness towards Americans in many of these arrangements. And the other thing that I think he wanted to reset was, you know, we have, I think, an obligation as a country to think about strategically what are the things that we want to produce in the United States that we don't want to be totally dependent on countries around the world, especially countries that may not have America's best interest at heart, such as things like chip manufacturing, such as things like active pharmaceutical ingredients, rare earth minerals, for instance, things like that that are going to be essential to the future, essential to the present. And, you know, those are key things that we, I think, need to have a national discussion around that are a key national security interest of the United States to produce here. So I think that's even separate from the other reset of a fairness or a question and getting to more free trade. But I think that has to be a essential part of the discussion when it comes to national security as well. Because at the end of the day, I think, you know, free trade brings prosperity, and we can't produce everything that we want, right? And so there is a huge element of comparative advantage. And this goes back to Adam Smith and David Ricardo and the great economists of old. But there needs to be a realization that some of these arrangements need to be reset. And I think that's what some of the discussion in Washington has been. And that's where I think some of my friends on the right perhaps got it a little bit wrong and didn't give the president enough time to have some of these key discussions.
Yeah, well, I am all for free trade. I think government should stay out of it. I think let people buy what they want from where they want. I think fewer fees and fewer taxes and frankly none at all would be great. I think that's all better for everybody. But the moment the other side puts tariffs on your goods, it's no longer free trade. And some of these tariffs were like 300% on our goods. But you brought up a great point, which is a point that I share, is that people on our side of the aisle really missed the long-term goal, which is that Trump is reshaping the economy itself here. He's moving us towards a manufacturing economy. And it does no good to recreate America as a manufacturing economy if you have no place into which you can sell those goods because of those other countries' high tariffs on the goods.
Right. And, you know, I think that's it's a key part of the discussions right now going on. You know, look, I mean, I think you have Secretary Bessent right now at Treasury, who's been a key, I think, moderating voice in this discussion. There was, you know, obviously a little bit of a freak out in the equities market in the opening days after this was discussed in April, as the rebalancing was talking about with tariffs. And you have somebody like Bessent coming in and reassuring markets and reassuring Americans mm-hmm. that, you know, the goal here is to find these deals with our friends and to look for ways to expand free trade. I mean, I'm as free trade as they come. And so I think that we do need to find immediately our allies around the world that are willing to have these deals, zero for zero relationships of free trade. But then we need to probably look at things to isolate bad actors around the world too, and make sure that we're doubling down with our friends and we're making sure that the bad actors around the world are not holding all the cards when it comes to the manufacturing of some of these key ingredients and some of these elements of chip manufacturing, let's say, that are going to be key to the economy going forward.
I absolutely love Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent. I love the fact that he was a former professor I think that really is so key, because you can hear it when he talks about these things. He does a good job of explaining things in ways that people can understand. So I love the calming effect that he has on things. You know, the left keeps disparaging everything that Trump does, especially on the economy, because that's his true strong point. And yet Trump just came back with multi-trillion-dollar deals. Maybe it's just me, but I don't recall any multi-trillion-dollar deals that Biden did while he was in office. Did I miss that?
I think you may have. And this would have been key time during the Biden years to double down with our friends as well. There was a missed opportunity there. And I'm glad to see that the Trump administration is now taking up the mantle of looking at, let's say, the UK and looking at Australia and looking at Japan and looking at South Korea. There's lots of good national security reasons for doing this as well. But I mean, the economy piece of it is key. And that's why having the Treasury Secretary, I know he's been flying around the world in recent days, meeting with our allies and trying to reassure them our desire to have a freer trade arrangement. I think that's very net positive.
Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Jonathan Williams, the President and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And welcome back. We're talking today with Jonathan Williams. He's the President and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. He is also the co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report on the economic competitiveness among the states and their economic growth, how they did and how things look in the year ahead. You can find out more about that by heading to richstatespoorstates.org. And spoiler alert, you probably won't be happy with Oregon if you live in Oregon. So yeah, there you go. All right. So, Jonathan, in this segment, actually, before we leave the whole tariff thing, there was an interesting quote. Trump, on his way into that meeting over on Capitol Hill this week, Tuesday, he was asked about the tariffs. He says, "Do you know how many auto plants are being built now in this country because of the tariffs? 3 just announced yesterday that they are building." He says, "You know, I love this. It's like a revolution happening on America, and I'm all for it." So there you go, the tariff effect. So ever since Trump got elected, I have said that if anybody was to derail his agenda to make America great and the economy great again, it will be Republicans. And from what I'm seeing, Republicans want to keep funding a lot of the waste that was uncovered under DOGE. And that's just the little bits that they've looked at so far. They didn't even bother to look at things like the new Green Deal or environmental spending and all the rest. And I saw recently that the Republicans want to keep that funded until 2030. So what was the point of DOGE discovering waste, abuse, and outright fraud if not to correct the problems? I mean, I hope this was just not some excuse to score political points on the opposition, because if that's all it was, it's going to undermine trust in Republicans.
Well, you know, I'm somewhat of an optimist, as you know, Mark. And so, you know, I think that there are some ways that DOGE came in and started identifying savings within the agencies that the cabinet secretaries and agency heads can actually take action unilaterally and find these positions that weren't doing anything and finding, you know, some areas of waste, fraud, and abuse and improper payments and things like that that could be done and find some real savings that way. So I think there's that to be said. Now, unfortunately, that number is not large compared to the broad national debt and other challenges that we face as a country. And so what we're going to need going forward is we're going to need a Congress with a lot of leaders that want to look big picture. And as this moment in time, and as Elon goes back into the private sector and as the DOGE effort kind of finalizes up its reports, we're going to need to keep going ahead in much bigger, bolder ways and address things that some people are uncomfortable addressing if we're going to get to the bottom of $36 trillion plus. And one of those things that's actually come up in the last 2 or 3 weeks and it's gotten the typical media hyperbole and the gnashing of teeth from the left-wing progressives in Washington, D.C., and that is addressing Medicaid waste, fraud, and abuse.
Yes.
And I think that's a national discussion that is long overdue to be had, and it's been one that is playing out as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act renewal as it goes forward is a key area of budget savings. But more important than that, I think we need a national kind of rethinking about what is it that Medicaid was created to do.
Yeah.
And of course, that was a program for the truly needy to provide health care for the disabled and those with children that couldn't work and the elderly. And what it's turned into because of namely Obamacare has been a complete reversal of that, where almost all the new growth in Medicaid in recent years has been directed towards able-bodied working age males with no children. Now, let's think about that for a second. When you pull that, you know, it's not just a, hey, you know, those of us in policy think this is a bad idea. Common sense tells the American people that maybe for a social safety net program like Medicaid that's supposed to help the truly vulnerable, we should not be using it to subsidize people living in their parents' basements that are able-bodied men that should be in the workforce. And so having a national conversation around that, as well as improper payments and going to illegal aliens, let's say, in states that have all the incentive to expand under Obamacare, this is something that we've needed to talk about for a very long time, and I'm really happy that as part of this discussion, at least we're starting to raise awareness around this massive area of government savings, because that DOGE is going to be good, but it's not going to be enough to address the national debt crisis that we face as a country.
Yeah, absolutely, and I really hope that they will work to codify a lot of the cuts that are there. But you mentioned Medicaid fraud. You know, speaking of being optimist, I feel really good about RFK being there. I really think that he will go after that. I think that he's going to work to cut all of that. Some of the fines that DOGE found were absolutely shocking. All of the money being funneled there through USAID, the billions going to NGOs, billions spent on illegal immigrants. And what really bothers me about those fines is the Democrat response to those fines. It boiled down to keep your hands off our fraud. And you got these lawsuits, the outcries, the lies saying that Trump is going to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid rather than what it was. It was to weed out the fraud, meaning that there would be more for everybody that are legitimately on Social Security or on Medicaid and the rest. I mean, finding fraud and exposing it and getting rid of it should be something that unites us, shouldn't it?
Well, it should. And, you know, I think that conservatives and those that look for ways to find these efficiencies and root out the bad actors in Medicaid and other programs, I mean, they need to stand on the moral high ground here. I was just having dinner with a member of Congress earlier this week who's an ALEC alum who used to be a state legislator, and they're in their opening months as a member of Congress, and they were telling me about the protests of folks in wheelchairs this week about the supposed Medicaid cuts that are happening. And first of all, you know, there are no Medicaid cuts on the table. We're talking about Medicaid still growing, even with these reductions in waste, fraud, and abuse, something like 2% over the next 10 years versus 3% currently. So we're talking about only a reduction in the rate of growth of a program that's been expanded exponentially from its existence. But the second more important point of this is, you know, I think Americans need to follow the facts on this one to say, you know, who is it that's actually going to be cut? It's going to be those that are on the program illegally, those are getting improper payments, but also it's going to be working age, able-bodied men with no children that need to be in the workforce. And that's something that 80 or 90% of Americans agree with. And yeah. So you see these professional protest groups and the AstroTurf type groups out there with trotting out folks in wheelchairs. You know, this is somewhat repugnant because these Medicaid reforms are actually going to save the program for those that are in disabled situations or are truly needy. That is something that is totally lost on the liberal media, but needs to be said and re-said, because Medicaid should exist, and it should exist for those that truly need it, not the able-bodied working-age adults.
Yeah. Okay, let's cut a little bit early here. Coming up, we're going to be talking about too much spending, too much debt, and that big, beautiful bill with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about making America great again, and that starts with making the economy great again. And to do that, we're talking with Jonathan Williams. He is the President and Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. Find them at alec.org, and we'll link that up on today's show page, which is 15-21 on iSpyRadio.com. And so, Jonathan, I'd like to talk about Trump's big, beautiful bill, but to set the table for that, let's first look at Moody's recent downgrade of the United States credit rating. It dropped one notch from AAA, which is the highest possible rating, to AA1, mainly due to our massive debt and the rising costs just to pay interest on that debt. And let me read a bit here from Moody's report. Quote, we expect federal deficits to widen, reaching nearly 9% of GDP by 2035, up from 6.4% in 2024, driven mainly by increased interest payments on debt, rising entitlement spending, and relatively low revenue generation. So I disagree with that last one. I think we're going to see a lot more revenue generation, but it's my understanding that we are spending 20% of our federal revenue just on interest payments, and that currently we're borrowing every dollar that we do spend on paying the interest on that debt. So we are using credit cards to pay off the interest on other credit cards. If I was Moody's, I would have downgraded this further.
Well, this is a long time coming, right, Mark? I mean, the other agencies have already downgraded the United States debt by a notch in previous iterations of this. And so this is kind of the last shoe to fall in this approach where we're at, you know, $36.8 trillion of national debt. And, you know, it's not that we have a revenue shortfall in the United States either. I mean, that's, I think, where some of these bond rating agencies get it wrong, is we do not have a revenue shortfall. We have a spending problem in the United States. And to the fact that they address that again and reaffirm that, that's good. But, I mean, that's also, I think, the reason that there's the big, beautiful bill being talked about, right, is that there includes budget reductions as well as includes pro-growth tax relief that, you know, I think we're guaranteed a recession, as I said, if we don't pass some sort of an extension of the Trump tax cuts.
Yes.
And, you know, I think with the element that a lot of these folks forget about, and certainly the CBO scores don't reflect this, but that is the dynamic effect of pro-growth tax reform. And we saw it in 2017 with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act originally, when trillions of dollars came back into the United States and went to work here versus abroad, because we reduced business tax rates and incentivized businesses to bring back manufacturing. I mean, this is not just a recent phenomenon. I remember after TCJA, we had auto manufacturing coming to Michigan from Mexico. And when could we have ever said that in the last 30 or 40 years?
Right.
It's because the American economy became that much more competitive. What happens if the tax cuts on individuals and small businesses are not renewed? We have a massive economic growth problem, and growth is going to be key, I think, to getting our way out. We can't do it just with growth. We need to do it with smart spending reductions and making sure government gets reduced back to size. But economic growth of at least 2.5 or 3 or 4% GDP growth is what needs to be the goal, because growth does cover a multitude of sins. And we know, even if we're successful when it comes to spending reduction, there's still going to be more spending that we don't get to in any round of potential spending cuts. And so that pathway towards key economic growth. And how do you do that? You empower individuals and entrepreneurs and small businesses to be that growth engine, just like we saw in 2017. It can be done again with tax reform.
Yeah, well, you mentioned business coming back to places like Michigan. I really think that's why Moody's is wrong on at least that one element about they see lower revenue generation, and I just think that's incorrect. Trump has already had all these trillion-dollar deals coming. He's got new manufacturing coming back in, so I think we're going to see increased revenue, not less.
And by the way, Mark, sure. This isn't just theory. I mean, the theory in the Laffer curve shows us exactly this, that when you cut tax rates, especially on capital-based taxes and things that matter for economic growth, you don't see the revenue loss. And in some cases, you see revenue gains. And this isn't just theory, because we went through this in 2017, mm-hmm. and everyone said the Chicken Little story of the sky is going to be falling and we're going to lose all this revenue. And it was like, dear, you know, this whole scare tactics of the media that they usually do on tax cuts. But now that we have an actual real-world experience from the 2017 tax cuts, we know that the losses that they were projecting did not occur, and we saw that much more economic growth and money put back to use in our American economy after the tax cuts, that it actually, we saw an uptick by far of what the revenue they suggested it would be. And it was far from the tax cuts only for the millionaires and billionaires, like people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer warned about as well. It was a broad-based tax relief. So it's been done in practice, and it will absolutely be done again if they can get the tax relief passed this year.
Yeah, well, I think Chicken Little should be the new mascot for the Democrats. As far as the spending is concerned, because you said we need smart spending cuts, I don't get the sense that, I shouldn't say all Republicans, but certainly some of them are definitely not taking the spending seriously. I just said that about Moody, and that's one of the reasons, if not the main reason, why they had reduced our credit rating, because of all of the spending and the debt and everything else. And some of them seem as eager to keep spending as the Democrats are. And I saw a great chart. It was on, I forget his name. He was a former congressman, but we'll put it up on iSpyRadio.com and you can see the video. And he shows this chart. It shows 2019, we're at $4.5 trillion spending. By 2020, with the pandemic, Trump blew it up to 6.5. But then after Biden took office, it increased from there to 6.8 and then stayed above $6 trillion in 2022 and 2023. By 2024, we hit $6.75 trillion. And so let's make a proposal here. Why not return to 2019? You know, 2019 or bust. Going back to 2019 levels, that would give you an immediate $2.3 trillion in savings, and then add in the Doge cuts and other fraud and green energy and environmental boondoggles. And maybe we could even start paying off the debt. So why aren't they looking at reducing spending that drastically in order to get us on track? Because until we get rid of this massive deficit every year, the debt's just going to keep compounding.
Well, let me tell you two different lines on this, and one you've heard me say multiple times, but it rings true in situations like these, which is the great economist Thomas Sowell always says, you know, the first law of economics is there's such a thing as a scarcity of resources, and we don't have everything that we want. That's why we need to economize. But the first law of politics is to ignore the first law of economics.
Yes.
And so that is the situation that we face ourselves in. And the closer we get to a reelection campaign for individuals, the more they follow the law of politics and less the laws of economics, unfortunately. And then the other thing, I forget who coined the term. I mean, in Washington, D.C., we have essentially three political parties. We have Republicans, we have Democrats, and then we have appropriators. And there's a whole branch of government that kind of sees it as their view that they're the keepers of the purse and they're the ones that dole out government resources. And I don't know that they see the world the same way that maybe you and I see this. And I don't know that they see the urgency of the national debt where it is today. And that's a problem. And I'm not throwing all appropriators into that category because there's some very good conservative minds that sit on appropriations committees here. But I think, it's unfortunately, and sometimes it gets worse with time and spent in Washington, D.C., but people kind of think of it that way and that mentality that these resources are governments that they're doling out versus that these are the people's dollars, right? And we serve to represent the people. And if we want a future as a country, when it comes to being a country that's on sound financial footing, we absolutely have to stop business as usual and do things like, hey, are we going to notice a difference if we go back to pre-pandemic spending levels? The vast majority of Americans would not notice a difference in their lives if the federal government spent at 2019 levels versus what it's spending today, given all of the extra waste that was added to government spending in the Biden administration.
Yeah. Just giveaways, unfortunately. Okay, we are up against the clock. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue this discussion about Trump's big, beautiful bill after this with Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find them at alec.org. And you can encourage your legislators and other public officials down to the city level to join ALEC to get insights and economic policy advice to improve state and local economies. And who doesn't want a good economy? Well, actually, some states probably do, apparently, based on how they handle things. But not every state. So anyway, Jonathan, as far as the big, beautiful bill, there's a lot more to talk about here. And we were talking about the fraud and all of that. And looking back at that and how Democrats were howling rather than doing what they should have done, which is they should have joined in my opinion, because this is, you know, getting rid of fraud and wasting taxpayer dollars. And some of it was outright fraud. There's no two ways about that. What the Democrats should have done at that point is they should have said, boy, if you thought that Republicans found fraud, wait until we start looking. And, you know, there's a danger there because I'm suspicious that the Democrats probably have far more fraud than the Republicans did. But even so, if they found that, that would be good because it gives them a chance to admit, hey, we've made a mistake here and now we need a chance to fix it. It's the same kind of approach, I think, that needs to apply to spending because both sides should be concerned about this. I don't get the sense that I certainly know that the Democrats don't appear to be willing to do any spending cuts. And too many Republicans are afraid of that. Do you know what Trump's plan is to get rid of the deficit and to start paying down debt? I mean, does he have one, or is it more about stopping the bleeding at this point?
Well, I think the first step you take that when you're in a hole is you stop digging it deeper. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with turning off so many of these new wasteful programs of the Biden administration and actually curtailing them, right? And that's going to be part of this discussion around the big, beautiful bill of the Green New Deal style tax credits being curtailed and finding other government savings there. In the first Trump administration, I was invited in by the Office of Management and Budget, and I know there was discussions around some long-term spending reductions and ways to analyze, let's say, what does the federal government own? This is a big, big question out west, as you all know, is, you know, how much of the West is federal lands, right? You talk to people like U.S. Senator Mike Lee, and he'll remind you that 60% plus of Utah is owned by the federal government of acreage. You go to Nevada, that number jumps towards what, almost 90% or in that vicinity of all acres are owned by the federal government. And that just considers the land out west. We're talking about real estate. We're talking about buildings. We're talking about other things that the federal government owns. And back then, I mean, it was kind of an unsatisfactory answer from many individuals that the federal government really has a hard time even valuing how much it owns, let alone starting to figure out how to sell things off that makes sense and actually put those assets back into use for private sector entrepreneurs and put buildings back in the use of real estate and other things. And by the way, putting back on the tax rolls as well. When the government owns these assets, they're not being collected property taxes, for instance, on local governments or other ways that could be used for private sector economy purposes, right? And so I think that's a huge area to look at. But there's lots of others, too. I mean, and I think like the willingness to talk about the waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid and the way that states have signed up illegal aliens, for instance, for Medicaid and SNAP coverage. I think the SNAP issue is going to be a very big one on food stamps. And what does that look like going forward? Yep. And that's a shared program between the federal government and states. So much of this that's going to be talked about, I think, is going to be key for states and state policymakers to stay engaged, because that's going to be what it takes. It's going to be an all-the-above approach of state, local, and federal governments coming together to say, let's root out waste, fraud, and abuse, and let's get this national debt problem under control.
Absolutely. We have got to do that. There's a lot more to talk about in terms of Trump reducing the deficit here, but I think we're going to have to leave it there for now. But speaking of spending and deductions, one of which is apparently a hard sell right now, again, to some Republicans, is the SALT deduction. And this is something you and I have talked about previously. Been a while since we have, but SALT is state and local taxes, and Republicans are looking at raising the amount that can be deducted from the federal income tax, which is a real benefit to people who live in high tax states like New York and California. So talk to us about that impact, because and I understood that Trump was against keeping those, and yet the last thing I saw was suddenly, while in the negotiations, we've quadrupled the amount that they'd be allowed to take off.
Well, this is a key element of why it's taken a while to get to a negotiation on the big, beautiful bill, is they have a handful of Republicans from the New York and New Jersey area that are understandably hearing from constituents that taxes are too high in those kind of big blue states that have high taxes and high spending. However, I think their anger is misplaced, right? The anger, in our view, ought to be sent towards elected officials in Albany and Trenton and Springfield, Illinois, and Annapolis, Maryland, and Sacramento, California, and Salem, Oregon, for that matter. And those discussions are driven by state and local government taxing and spending decisions. The idea that those big spending decisions by big blue states ought to be subsidized by hardworking Americans in red states that are cutting taxes and looking to become more competitive raises some major fairness issues. Not to discount the issue of property taxes and income taxes being sky high in the blue states, it's just not being appropriately dealt with when you ask to socialize those costs around the rest of the country. And that is a big point where those elected officials in those states in Congress think that they're not going to win re-election or if they don't go back with some sort of a deal on SALT. Now, to remind people, before the 2017 Trump tax cuts, the state and local tax deduction, at least on paper, was unlimited. The Trump tax cuts limited it to $10,000 you could deduct in your state and local taxes per year. And now, right now, the discussions are really all over the map, but maybe towards $30,000 or $40,000 SALT cap. Now, I put that out there with an asterisk. And the big asterisk here is many high-income individuals from the blue states that previously thought they had an unlimited SALT deduction, they sent their taxes off to their preparers to file. And what they didn't realize was pre-Trump tax cuts, almost all the benefits of the SALT deduction got taken away by that thing called the AMT, the alternative minimum tax. That was in law, and it was affecting high and middle income taxpayers and taking away the deductions that they could take off their returns. And then because of the Trump tax cuts in 2017, the AMT got phased out to nearly nothing at this point. And so now the discussion is around getting a SALT deduction back now without an AMT there. But I think it's a little bit unfair fair to judge it's apples and orange discussion, because what was happening before was people were getting this unlimited SALT deduction, at least they thought, but in fact they weren't because of the AMT that was in effect prior to the Trump tax cut.
Yeah, and I really, you know, as we've said before, I really don't, I know neither one of us do, like those SALT deductions because it rewards bad decisions. It allows blue states to keep high taxes rather than cut those state income taxes to be competitive with other states. And speaking of that, those pesky 50 test tubes of democracy, a recent study shows that other states are trying to lure businesses away from Oregon, and that's working. We'll talk about that next. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He's the president and chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Find out about the great work they do over at alec.org, A-L-E-C.org. We'll link that up on today's show page 15-21 on iSpyRadio.com. And so, Jonathan, Oregon has had a string of economic problems here. The May revenue forecast was not good. They are projecting that Oregon is going to lose $757 million of revenue. There have been a number of accounting errors that were just found, $1.8 billion. ODOT accidentally added $1 billion from the feds twice, so they had to take that off. And, you know, I just look at this, and when it comes to the various states' policies, attracting businesses to your state is a bit like a dating game. Oregon, unfortunately, is like an overweight, heavily tattooed, pink-haired woman with nose rings sitting at the end of the bar complaining to her transgender lesbian best friend about how hard it is to find a good man, as she orders her fifth whiskey and lights up a joint. And if anyone did try to get to know her, they'd quickly get an earful on things like DEI and green energy and racism, not to mention how evil capitalism is and how greedy corporations are. It's all men's fault rather than spending one moment looking at herself. That's the image Oregon is projecting to the business community nationally. So I'm baffled. Why can't Oregon attract good businesses?
Well, I think the first thing is it needs a total overhaul when it comes to the policy environment, right? I mean, and Oregon coming in at 43rd best in rich states, poor states. There are only a few states in the country that have a worse economic environment than Oregon. And, you know, this is a story that you know well, that listeners know well, that Oregon for many years could outperform because it wasn't California, and it could outperform and had zero sales tax and had some positive attributes to it. But years and years now of getting bogged down by some of the worst income tax rates, highest rates in the country, by having a death tax, by having things like high minimum wages, and just down the line, almost the entire 15 factors we look at, things to worry about when it comes to economic factors that matter for growth. And it turns out when you translate that, Oregon had been a in-migration state. You know, one of the biggest things that we track every year in rich states, poor states, is how much Americans vote with their feet from state to state. 50 laboratories of democracy. You can only get away with bad policy for so long before it starts taking effect. And it turns out, people always wondered, well, if things were so bad in Oregon, why are people still moving to Oregon? Well, that's not the case anymore. As you know well, over the last couple of years, Oregon has dipped into some pretty substantial out-migration numbers in the tens of thousands of individuals leaving Oregon for one of the other 49 states. That should be a wake-up call for every policymaker across Oregon to say, even with all the inherent advantages that Oregon had, all the positive things that had kept Oregon afloat, those things are not enough to overcome a horrible business climate with some of the highest taxes in the country. Even next to California doesn't make you look good enough to invest in these days when it comes to Oregon. And that's a sad state of affairs, but it's one that I think people just need to recognize and say, what is it that we need to start changing if we want to grow again as a state and if we want to be a state that's open for business?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mentioned in that previous segment a study done by the University of Oregon, and there's a lot of things in there that sound pretty terrible when you start looking through that, but here's a pull quote from KGW's reporting on this. Nearly a quarter of responding businesses, and they got 400 responses, nearly a quarter of those reported being approached by out-of-state recruiters, and more than two-thirds of those either expanded their presence outside of Oregon or have even already packed up and moved out. There is no way to look at that and not think that's pretty terrible.
Well, you know, it's a stark reminder that the policy and elections have consequences, right? And that if you're a recruiter and you're, let's say, representing an economic development authority in Idaho or Nevada or Wyoming or Utah, Arizona, you've got a ton of states, even if you want to stay on the western side of the Rockies, that are so open for business and have competitive business environments and low taxes and offer all kinds of very positive things for entrepreneurs to come in. You don't have to sell that all that hard when you're comparing and you're going to look at businesses in states like Oregon or California or states that are from, you know, are high taxes and anti-business policies. Many times it doesn't even take somebody to have to come and sell a business to leave. They're looking automatically at the policy environments and the cost savings that they could have. And by the way, giving their employees a much better quality of life at a lower cost of life by moving out of high tax states. It's not just good for the bottom line, it's good for employees and it's good for customers across the board. And so oftentimes we often say the best economic development strategy is just getting policy right.
Yes.
And generally the states that have to spend the most on economic development efforts are the ones that are trying to compensate for bad policy to start with. But when you combine the states that have good policy and then they have aggressive economic development efforts, they're shooting fish in a barrel when they come to a state like Oregon, when you have the beleaguered business community that is told every year in Salem that if we have a deficit, we only need to have businesses tax more, and that'll be the solution to all of our problems.
Yeah, absolutely. We've used that example before. You're walking down the street. There's two stores, one on either side of the street. One store's window says, everything on sale. And the store on the other side of the street says, everything more expensive. Which store are you going into? That is state competitiveness in a nutshell. Jonathan, unfortunately, we are up against the clock with you. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. Always great to join you, my friend.
After our interview with Jonathan, the House did pass their version of the Big Beautiful Bill in the wee hours of Thursday morning. In a statement on X, President Trump said the bill includes massive tax cuts. No tax on tips, no tax on overtime. There is also stronger border security and funding for the Golden Dome missile defense shield. That's great, and there were spending cuts, including wasteful things like green energy, but not nearly at the scale needed. Now it goes to the Senate, where some senators are saying they want to soften what the House did to Medicaid and keep more green energy incentives. But at least a few senators said we cannot afford to keep spending the way that we have been, and they want even steeper cuts than the House sent over. If only there were dozens of them saying that. Not one Democrat in the House voted to pass the bill, which means all of Oregon's Democrat representatives do not believe you should keep more of your own money. Maybe they can organize some more hands-off-our-fraud protests. Or maybe, just maybe, Oregonians will finally be done with the image Oregon projects to the rest of the nation. Let's hope so, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.